Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, and welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret, your host, and we're getting ready for a big island, continuing our island tour, Discover Jamaica One Parish at a Time. We are in our 12th week of this particular segment. We're just checking out each one of the 14 parishes and bringing you some interesting nuggets of information that you might not have been familiar with or have just forgotten, like this senior citizen that hosts the show. I want to welcome my callers and also the people listening online. Welcome to the backyard. It is Wednesday, July 8th, and it's amazing how we've gone through half of the year already. It's almost going to be Christmas in July, which is something that the commercial people here in the South tend to play up, and we are always having a reminder that we're closer to Christmas than we were last month. So I want to welcome you again and to let you know something about Trelawney today, which is the featured parish. And I see we have, I want to welcome all our callers from 631 and 646. And I also want to welcome our callers online or our people listening online and remind you, the callers who are calling in by phone, that if you ever want to join the Labrish, grab an easy chair and pretend you're on the island somewhere under a tree with the nice trade winds blowing across your face. You can just relax for the next 60 minutes as we reminisce and dig up. And, you know, I hope that the callers calling in will raise their hands by touching one on their telephone. And I'll see a raised hand on my computer screen. You know, the technology nowadays on Blog Talk Radio is so great. And this old lady is so excited about it. So I like to see raised hands. So if it's just to say hello, good evening, or whatever, to offer your little tidbit if you know something about the parish of Trelawney or what we're going to labrish about this evening, just let me know by raising your hands. So I'm going to start off with reading from my wonderful gift from Jamaica, which is the Encyclopedia of Jamaican Heritage by Olive Senior. And for my listeners who love history, especially the history of Jamaica, this is a great resource. So I want to recommend it. That is something you could have for your library. Anyway, let's talk a little bit now about Trelawney. As you know, I've been talking about the different parishes, I've been doing a little research as to why it's named what it's named. And we've found with those we've done so far that it's always named after a governor or some important person back in the days, you know, when we were a colony way back. So I want to tell for the people who might not be familiar with Jamaica at all, because we do have some listeners who have never been, and some that might have been just as a visitor, and some of us that have left long ago and even forgot about some of the things we learned to school in school if we went to school there. So Trelawney is a North Coast parish, and in 1999, the population was a little over 72,000. In 1770, it was formed in 1770 from the eastern portion of St. James after the wealthy sugar planters of the coast complained that the parish capital of Montego Bay was too far away for them to conduct business. Martha Bray was the first capital of Trelawney with Rock as the shipping port. Rock was, the name of a town. But this was superseded in 1790 when the town of Falmouth was laid out. The parish was named after Sir William Trelawney, who was governor at the time it was formed. Lower Trelawney continued as a leading sugar area for some time, while the upper or hill areas were opened up by small settlers in the post-emancipation period. The parish encompasses part of the Cockpit Mountains. And for those of us who remember the old days when we used to travel over those mountains with the precipice, and as a young child, I remember being so scared, because in those days, I understand there are beautiful highways all over the island now, but I remember when I was growing up, and had to pass through that particular parish or anywhere near the Cockpit Mountains, that the slopes, I don't know if that's the proper name, but I know they always refer to them as a precipice. And if any of our callers online have anything, you know, the memory is sometimes going. I'm a senior citizen, so sometimes I don't remember what we used to call things, but I remember that distinctly. And it used to really scare me as a little girl, because my favorite parish is coming up next, week after next, because I used to travel to Westmoreland, and I can't wait to talk about some of my things that I remember about that. But I also get some of my information from Wikipedia, and for those who might not be familiar with it, it's an online encyclopedia of, you know, just about everything you want to know. But they have a little more information about Trelawney. And again, I want to welcome our listeners from 631-646-631. Also, we have a couple of listeners from the 631 area code. So do touch one on your telephone if you want to join the Labrish, and don't leave me alone in the backyard. So join me here. My co-host is doing something with school this evening, so she's not going to be available. So now in 1770, the wealthy planters in St. James, I suppose there were not a lot of them, and they were scattered all over. So you can imagine if in my day it was a little difficult getting around, and I'm talking about perhaps the late 30s and early 40s, when the roads weren't so hot and the vehicles didn't have as much horsepower. I can imagine what it was like in 1770 for people to get around on their coaches or horses or whatever they used then. But from what I gather, that part of the island was originally settled by the wealthy, the real wealthy planters. As I do this research, I'm beginning to find out that even among the plantation owners, there were those that were richer or, of a higher caliber, whether it was through their birth into royalty or the part of England or Scotland or wherever they came from. But there was all this class prejudice even among them, because even in the history, it would refer to planters of a different one area being, different from planters from another area. So it just brings to mind that as humans, we have, there are things that is just sort of inborn in us, I suppose. And we always have to be working to overcome them. But I just thought that was a little sidebar as I do this research. Oh, I see I have a hand raised, so I'm going to welcome 646-479. The mic is open. Who am I speaking with?
That's me from the Bronx, the home of the Yankees.
Home of the Yankees. Yes, hello, my loyal listener from the Bronx, home of the Yankees. Just to help me out here. Is Yankee Stadium in the Bronx?
You bet.
It is?
Yeah, sure.
So what is in Brooklyn? What stadium is in Brooklyn?
I don't know, but everybody in the United States knows that.
Well, I'm in the United States. I beg your pardon, sir, but I didn't know that it's necessarily
that
in the Bronx.
From the Bronx, yeah.
It just refers
Met,
to it as the
Met
New Met York from, Yankees. Hey, it doesn't
the
say the Bronx
team.
Yankees.
Yeah.
I got you on that one.
Team.
Right. Okay, well, welcome to the show. And I know that you have, last week you told me you had some people from Falmouth, so we are going to have a good lavish tonight.
Well, that was last week. This week is a different week.
Oh, I got you. All right.
So we will see what develops.
All right. Well, welcome to the show. Well, let me just go on here to say that Trelawney is best known for its sugar estate and sugar factories. It had more sugar estates than any other parish. So there was need for a seacoast town to export it. Now, Falmouth became a thriving seaport and social center. The town had two of its own newspapers, the Falmouth Post and the Falmouth Gazette. I'm sure Dr. Lumsden perhaps have some information on that. I'll have to check with it with her website sometime, because she has some information, if whatever she could find about those old newspapers. But they weren't around in our time, were they, Lee?
No.
Okay. So Trelawney was also home to the largest group of Maroons on the island. A 1739 treaty between the Maroons and the English gave the Maroons freedom and land, which effectively put a stop to their raids because, they were sort of contentious. And for the people who might not know, the Maroons were the runaway slaves when the island transferred ownership from the Spanish to the English. Am I correct, Ray? Lay?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So they also, I saw mention in my research that they also intermarried into the Arawak Indians. Did you know that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they were, some of them had escaped before from Spanish, before the English took over, and had already taken up homes, I suppose, with the Indians. So when they, I suppose, during all of this war between the two colonists, a lot of them just, got away. So they had the largest, that area had the largest amount of Maroons. Were you about to say something?
No, I just wanted to mention that what you just said. In that era, there was a lot of intermarrying going on because Jamaica had taken a lot of refugees from European refugees, that is, from Europe. And of course, in 1775, that around that time, the census figures indicated about 209,617 whites were in Jamaica.
And they were not necessarily plantation owners, is what you're saying?
Yes, that's true.
Oh.
But and then hence you had this class thing cropping up because the English that had taken over weren't about to cede any of their status to anybody else so readily, you know.
Right.
You'll find out these plantation owners started to build these huge houses, great houses and stuff like that to show off. They're dotted all over the island, as a matter of fact, not just in the area we're talking about tonight. The houses, you know.
But it's interesting that you talk about, you know, the rich people wanting to show off even on their own class or color or whatever it is, culture.
Yeah.
Because the plantation owners who were making a lot of money, I suppose, always felt superior to the refugees who, I suppose, did not have plantations. Even if they were involved in some sort of business, they were dependent on them, you know, to support the business or other refugees. So it's all quite interesting as we discuss just human nature, you know, over the course of history. Anyway, it was interesting to note that most of the Maroons were actually from Trelawney. You know, they had more of them there. I just suppose because there were more sugar estates there. But were the Spanish into sugar? They were into sugar too?
No, the Spanish were not that interested in sugar. They were interested in gold. And since they didn't find any gold in the island, this is why they readily conceded to the British when the British came.
Yeah, they didn't fight as hard to keep the island.
To keep the island, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, in something I was doing the other day from one of those other parishes, it mentioned that it is believed that there's still buried treasure in Jamaica.
Well,
you know, from some of those shipwrecks and things like that.
When we were growing up, we heard, from the point of view of Port Royal alone, that there was all kinds of treasures at the bottom of the ocean there after the earthquake and things like that. I mean, still, you know, to this day, they didn't get what they thought might be buried under the harbor there. But there are other, like this location that we're talking about tonight was a very important seaport town, even prior to Port Royal.
Right, that's
for
true.
Trade, because it had a fairly natural harbor, and they could get all the sugar products and whatever else they brought from St. James and other areas to be sent out by ship from Trelawney. So it was a very, very important trading port.
Right.
Yeah.
It mentions here that most of the parish is flat with wide plains, such as a plain called Queen of Spain's Valley, which is 750 feet above sea level. and Windsor, which is 580 feet above sea level. Most of southern Trelawney is around 750 feet above sea level. The highest point in the parish is Mount Airy, which is 3,000 feet above sea level. Now I know why, perhaps the view is, you have such beautiful view when you're traveling in that particular parish. Now the southern section of Trelawney is part of the Cockpit country and is uninhabitable. It is therefore a natural reserve for, the plants and birds that we have out there. Now, we have 27 different species of birds that can be found there. And did you know that they have yellow snakes there?
No,
yellow snakes must be the name of a bird, along with the yellow snakes and the giant swallowtail. So that must be the name of a bird, swallowtail butterfly. No. It must be a snake. I didn't know we had snakes out there. Did you?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, apparently they might be confined to the Cockpit Mountains.
I hope so. I don't want to see them in my neck of the woods out there.
All right. Now, the giant swallowtail butterfly, the largest butterfly in the Western Hemisphere. And as I mentioned, and some of our listeners might find this interesting, I find it interesting that each parish would have something very special about it. There's not a parish that we've been covered so far that didn't have something that was unique to that particular part of the island. I don't know if you've been noticing that, Leigh, whether it was the amount of caves or, whatever, the bats or whatever, but here, these particular things they're mentioning here is because that part of the island in the Cockpit Mountains nobody can live there. And I suppose that is why these species of these special things are preserved.
Well, I had a friend in school that was very eccentric, and he used to go up into the Cockpit Mountains. And in fact, he used to ask me to get him the latest in bow and arrows, and and all this kind of stuff. And he would go up into the Cockpit Mountains and camp for a couple of weeks during the summer, and you would think you were in a different island.
Because apparently people can explore it and, as you say, hike and camp, but they can't really live.
If I'm not mistaken, I think there are still some people that are pretty remote from everybody.
You mean they actually live there? They
live up there, yeah.
Ah, without running water and all of that.
I'm not sure if they act as guides to people like him, and they live up there, but it's a very remote area, and the wildlife is different from you would normally see around other parts of the island, and he must have done quite a bit of
research
and uses bow and arrow on what I don't know,
right.
Whether it was,
they might even have some wild hogs there, because we did a parish one time that was known as the Lard Parish when the Spaniards had it, because it had so many wild hogs.
Mm.
But anyway, most of the parish has the typical limestone features of Cockpit, the sinkholes and caves and underground passages. There are about 48 caves, most with phosphate gatherings. These include the Windsor Cave. And I mentioned the last time with one of those parishes that you have foreign groups of people who are cave hunters, I think they call themselves or so.
Yeah.
And they travel all over the world to explore caves.
Yeah.
And I was reading, you know, I went to one of their websites, and they would document the times they went to Jamaica, and I think it was from Belgium or someplace. And I said, boy, you know, I never heard of these people. I suppose they don't make a big deal when they come to do something like that. And from what I gathered at this website, these people had been coming there, you know, the organization they belong to, have documentation on going to explore caves from way back, you know, long time ago, and people are still involved in that type of thing.
You know, also, I don't know if you came across this in your research, but I have a friend who owned this this area near Falmouth that was called Glistening Waters.
Glistening Waters.
Yeah, and in the evenings the water in this sort of a lake would just glisten. You know, you throw
from
storm,
the sulfate or something.
Yeah, something, some kind of a chemical reaction.
Because it has phosphorus deposits there.
Right, right, and he has since sold the place to a group of people from the U.S., and they, you know, in the evenings you can see people lining up to go over and visit the thing. You know, I have to pay now to go in there.
Right.
But it's just an interesting feature of the topical variety that you will find in different parts of the island.
Island. And people, I mean, the average person, especially foreigners or even people in the diaspora who perhaps have left Jamaica long ago and didn't travel a lot to the different parishes or parts of the island before we left, we don't know all of these different things because it mentions a lot here about it's known for its beauty and the phosphate deposits because, you know, these lakes and caves, one is called Windsor Cave and one is called Camaray Cave. And these are particular caves that are known for their beauty. And as you mentioned, it's perhaps the phosphate caused that kind of reaction in the water.
Okay.
Now, they have also found caves with carvings of the Arawak Indians, you know, in the Coppet Mountains there and in parts of Trelawney.
Yeah.
So there are several underground conduits with the longest running for 15 miles of underground connections.
Right,
now, the main rivers are Martha Bray, Rio Bruno, Cane, and Quashy, Q-U-A-S-H-I-E. I didn't know there was a Quashy River. Did you?
No, I know the other two, but I didn't know what Quashy.
Yeah, it says it here. I'm sure they know what they're talking about. I said, boy, there's so much that I personally didn't know. I didn't know there was a Quashy River in Trelawney. Anyway, Trelawney's source of employment comes from agriculture, manufacturing, and tourism. Rum and sugar are Trelawney's principal products. Other crops include banana, yam, strawberries. I didn't know that. Vegetables, pimento, coffee, ginger, and coconut. Though the fishing industry is declining, Trelawney still produces a large amount of fishes. There are 10 beaches along the coast, with more than 30 boats each, as well as 27 fish ponds. I suppose that they're talking about currently where they're, you know, cultivating fishes in ponds.
Well, not necessarily. I know people there who, for instance, there's a man that used to drive me around during the daytime, and he takes 2 days off to go fishing. Mm-hmm. And
you're talking about when you were a youngster or when you
visited? No, I'm talking about currently.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And what he does, the point being that fishing is still a big thing in the
thing
in the,
there,
you know.
Mm.
So in other words, he goes out and he fishes and brings back his catch and sells it.
Right.
And in there's a little fishing town in the area where I have some property, and the whole neighborhood comes down on different days until when the fishermen come in the mornings around
uh-huh.
8 o'clock. People buy the fish and they scale it right there, and sometimes they will prepare the fish for you if you want.
Wow.
And you would not believe that this is, I don't know if you've ever been to a fishing area or a little fishing village, but this is what that is. And
uh-huh.
adjacent to this fishing village is a little bohemia, like only artists are down there, and you can go and get crafts, arts and crafts that they produce on a daily basis. You can tell them what you would like, and they
custom made crafts.
Great.
The more natural an area is, more it is conducive to artists, because you know artists need nature around them to stimulate
mm-hmm.
their artistry. So I can see where places that are so naturally beautiful and not manicured beauty, you know, because there's a big difference between the two. Like
yeah.
some of the tourist areas that have been developed are manicured beauty. But the places that are just naturally beautiful is very conducive to that type of thing. I see that our co-host is here, so I'm going to open up the mic and welcome her. Good evening, Donna. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening. I was listening to you all talk about Trelawney and
Hi
how
Donna.
You doing? How you doing?
And I have to invite you all to speak up a little louder, because I'm having my regular phone is shut and I'm using my cell phone to talk. And the volume, I'm not sure if this is how the recording will be, but I can hardly hear you. So just talk up a little louder.
Both of you sound very clear, so I'm sure it'll be okay.
Oh, great. Yep. Great.
But I noticed that they have 25 factories that produce sugar, rum, and apparel, among other things. But 25 factories, so they make a bunch of rum there, don't they?
Oh yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
The place really smells rummy, Donna, when you go into. Yeah, it does. I used to go into a place called Gordontown, and you have to go right by a couple of sugar estates, and
uh-huh.
it smells like rum.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I was wondering if you had covered the notable citizens from Trelawney Parish.
Well, not yet. We were just talking broadly about Trelawney, and then we're going to talk. There's more information about Falmouth, actually, than Trelawney as a whole, because apparently, well, first of all, it's the fifth largest parish. I wanted to mention that. But Donna, you can. Would you like to share with us about the notable people?
Well, yeah. I thought what was really interesting about it was that the birthplace of six of the track and field athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's true.
I thought that was. I was like, wow. But then, you know, of course. They really took over just in 2008, so they really made a big dent in that. But it said the 200 meters with Usain Bolt, Valletta Wallace, Veronica Campbell Brown, Marvin Anderson, Omar Brown, Michael Frater, and Ben Johnson. And then it also talks about it, it's the birthplace of the 2008 USA Today High School Basketball Player of the Year, Samardo.
Donna, they must have fed all of these youngsters on rum and rum products.
No, it's the yam. It's the yam. It's the soil.
Okay.
All the vegetables. Hey, they got a lot of vegetables there. I mean, good grief,
yes.
They got everything, all the good stuff.
Yes.
Coffee,
and,
coconut, vegetables, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very true.
And different parts of the islands, because it has a different type of soil, I think quite likely have different vitamins and minerals. You know, that's quite likely. I don't know if any test has ever been done on that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that so many of them with those abilities would come from that part of the island.
Mm-hmm.
If you look on the map, Donna, you know, you can see Port Antonio or Portland way over here, and we're on the North Coast now.
Wasn't Prime Minister Scherer from
Yes, he was
area.
One of the And Donna, if you don't know how Scherer is, he's a politician and was one of the prime ministers.
Mm-hmm.
From that area, from Falmouth.
Mm. What did it say to talk about the type of land that it is? I mean, because it's not like we were in an area what was like kind of mountainous and, you know, so is this like, I mean, I would think it would be flatter or something with all the crops they're growing.
Yes. We mentioned that before, that it has a lot of flat lands. And it also has a lot of mountains because part of the parish is in the Cockpit Mountain, which is uninhabitable. But let's talk about the capital now, which is Falmouth. Now, the population there in 1991 was less than 8,000 people. You know, that's a small town. And it's the town in Jamaica that has best maintained the features and ambience of the past and has been declared a historic town. Most of its old buildings are in an advanced state of dilapidation anyhow. And though its restoration has many times been proposed, nothing on a large scale has been really tackled. And they talk about the architect who restored Rose Hall. Remember, we spoke about Rose Hall being restored to its original beauty by this famous person, Mr. Henderson. Anyway, you know, I suppose the whole town is too much of a big project for the Historic Association to tackle now, because like all other organizations, I'm sure funding is a problem. So it would be good if some people who love history and come into a big fortune would perhaps help to preserve those buildings, because, I mean, they go back. This town was really laid out because, I suppose, most of the planters, as I mentioned, who went there before might have been rich before they even got to Jamaica.
Well, not all of them.
No, not all of them. But
no, I'm just saying, I read where a former mayor came to Falmouth with not even a shilling in his pocket.
Oh, really?
And yet he became mayor, you know, because he had connections back in...
What period we're talking about there?
The 17, late 70s.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they're mentioning here that Falmouth...
1770.
It's perhaps the only town where the spirit of the 18th century Jamaica can still be felt. They're talking about now, present day now. And to some lingering extent seen in brick, stone, and timber. This is what the architect is declaring. And he thinks that it's important to try to preserve, you know, this town because of this history. And this is it was built between 1791 and 1970. He was writing about this period between 1791 and 1970. But so far, you know, nothing has been started. But it was built sort of in a Georgian style of the 18th century.
Yeah.
And it is a small town on the coast where an abundance of domestic buildings were created in a single yet charming classical elements and adapted to local conditions. So they brought all of this architectural designs with them, but made it adaptable or adapted it to the area. You know, so that's perhaps what made it so unique. Now, and I suppose the city was sort of laid out, it was planned, and they sold lots. It was like a development. It was the only part of the island where they said, I'm talking about in the 17-something, you know, that was done. People bought lots, and they're referring to some of the things that they built as townhouses. So are you familiar with Falmouth? Because I don't remember, you know, that town itself. Do you, Leigh?
Yes, I do. I have property there.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
So you can tell us more about this formation, because they're saying here it was one of the few towns in Jamaica that was laid out from 1771.
Yeah, well, when you go into the town of Falmouth, you can see readily that the buildings are very old and dilapidated. Some are almost like they're falling down, because from what you just said, and it is true, they were built way back when and in grand fashion. And I don't think they were ever like refurbished. Maybe they have, because I really can't see how they could stand up for such a long time. But on the other hand, you can see that it would be better for them either to take down tear them down, but this definitely would not be put up in a Georgian fashion anymore.
Right.
But it would be a big task, because there is a very run-down-looking town when you go there.
Right, I got it.
You know, and the streets are so narrow. It's laid out from the old times, you know.
Mm-hmm. They claim that it's the only one still existing of its kind in all of the Caribbean, you know, in that style.
Okay.
And one of the reasons it's so unique is because it was like a planned community, whereas I suppose on other parts of the islands you had people who just randomly built. Settled in an area and built a plantation house or something like that.
From what we've said so far, this area was so important that it attracted the, if you want to say, well-to-do types to come there and trade, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to live. People came
right.
there and took up residence.
And they were not necessarily plantation owners, is what you're
right.
saying.
Yeah.
I got you. So that I suppose that's why they referred to them as condominiums.
Probably.
Even in those days.
And also, they are around that same period that we're talking about, the 1750s through 1790s. There's a lot of missionary work going on in that area. The parish church. I know the Catholic church that was put up around that time is still up. It's still a church that maybe in this case they had done some rejuvenation of the building, but you can see the vintage from way back, and it's still there in town. I can't speak for the Moravian church, because they do, that was, I think, one of the first churches on the island, the first church to be put up in that area.
Right.
And much later, of course, the Catholic church that I was talking about. But the Baptist church was introduced there. All of the major churches around that time were represented there.
Interesting. Anyway, the land on which Falmouth was built was bought from Edward Barrett, who
To be called Barrettstown.
Really?
Yeah.
Who also donated the land for the Anglican Church.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Now, they say his townhouse at 1 Market Street was built in 1799 and was one of the original buildings of the town. And now Falmouth is one of the few towns on the island that was laid out according to the plan. Lots were sold, and the rich planters and merchants eagerly bought them. A few years after it was formed, Falmouth had 150 houses and was steadily built up over the next 40 years until around 1830, when its steady decline began. Falmouth was created at the height of the prosperity that came from sugar. The parish was one of the richest sugar areas in the island, at one time having 88 estates. When the sugar industry declined in the mid-19th century, coastal towns such as Falmouth declined in importance also.
Right.
Now, in its heyday, the town was economically and socially on par with Kingston. It supported many businesses and more than one weekly newspaper, which I mentioned the two before. The Falmouth Post went on from 1835 to 1876. And Falmouth was noted for the introduction of anesthesiast in the extraction of teeth and scientific experiments by David Lindow in 1833, a Jewish merchant and self-taught chemist. He developed a method of determining the total nitrogen in fertilizer, and it was adapted by the U.S. government. Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
He was a Jewish merchant. So from what I'm gathering, you know, it attracted the rich planters, but also the merchants who had things to trade and had money, I suppose, bought up these properties when the town was laid out, because they were sold sort of as lots. I suppose it was owned by this man Barrett before it was sold. So it's just all very interesting information coming together. But it doesn't say the name of the Jewish merchant. Yeah, David Lindow. David Lindow is who he was, the science. The person who experimented and came up with, you know, knocking you out, I suppose, when you took your teeth out. Now, the remains of old wharves and warehouses along the sea are among the reminders today of the town's former importance. It was the port from which sugar was shipped and at which all the imported goods needed at the estate in the interior were landed. Sometimes as many as 27 ships would be in the harbor at one time. Of course, there were small sailing ships then. The largest
Is anybody from the area holding their hands up to?
Well, I hope if anybody's online, there seem to be some people listening on their computers. But I'd like to ask any of the callers that are online, if you have any information about Falmouth or Trelawney, please raise your hands and join the library. Now, sugar in those days were shipped in large barrels called hogheads. Remember we ran into this word already about hogheads? That's what the measure was, you know, instead of, I suppose, barrels, they called the large barrage. Why would they call them that? But you know, they shipped rum and things in that. Each hogshead weighed 1.02 tons. Mule or ox-drawn carts brought the hogsheads into town for loading onto the ship. It would take 6 men to put one of those hogsheads on board. Wow. The ships depended on the trade winds to blow them back home. So we're enjoying the trade winds in our easy chair as we sit in the backyard, and we can just imagine how important, we didn't really know how important those winds were to the people who were waiting for the wind to blow them back home with their ships full of hogheads, did we, Leigh?
Yeah, well, you have to realize that the ships in those days were sail ships. And
right.
You needed wind to blow them, so.
And I am assuming that the heavier, the more hogheads they had on the ship, perhaps is the more harder it would be to get started. But listen to this: they would sometimes have to wait in port for up to 1 month until they got the right breeze.
Yeah.
Each ship carried about 20 sailors, and while they waited, they would create an uproar, you know what I mean, I'm laughing, an uproar in the town. I suppose they were all getting drunk, so much so that the town fathers...
They weren't just going to sit there and wait, you know, there's a lot of rum around, Donna.
Oh my gosh, but you know, in those days, those people used to drink so much anyhow.
Yeah.
And now... The town fathers were saying that they could not stay in Falmouth later than 6 o'clock. They were having a curfew. If caught, they were to be jailed for the night. This seemed to have had little effect, for in 1803, the town had a stone cage built to lock up the drunken sailors. Ain't that something? The cage cannot now be seen, as it was torn down to make way for the market, but was probably similar to the cage in Montego Bay. Apparently, there's still a cage visible in Montego Bay.
Mm.
So they actually had to cage them like animals because they were so boisterous.
Well, no, not necessarily. A cage is a place where
it's an enclosed area. I'm just being funny.
Well,
I'm sure
like
they
animals.
Were quiet. You know, if they make it, and who knows, the rum might have been more potent in those days.
Well, don't forget, this is not refined rum we're talking about. You know, this is
right,
rum from the estate,
like White Lightning.
Which is over 150%. Proof.
Well,
so,
now that's what it is now, but wonder what it was in those days.
No, well, you know, the raw rum from the estate is probably what they're talking about, you know.
Right. Anyway, it says, aside from the sailing ships from North America or England, Falmouth Harbor was alive with a great deal of local traffic, including the canoes of fishermen. In the old days, water transportation between coastal towns was of great importance, especially since few roads existed. The canoes they were for hire between Falmouth and the neighboring harbors. The harbor would also be thick with a special kind of boat called a drogher. You ever, how do you say that?
Droga.
I never heard of that. The Droger distributed goods brought in by the sailing ships between Falmouth and the other towns, serving the same purpose as delivery trucks and vans today. So I suppose they used to sail around, and people would come and they would deliver the things at different parts of the parish.
Yeah. Well, now don't forget, if the location of Falmouth would be in between, like, if you would visualize on your map between Montego Bay and Runaway Bay and Ocho Rios.
So they have a big coastline, is what you
say.
Right.
The other thing to keep in mind is that the ocean didn't come all the way into the port because you had these coral breakers. So you needed these little ships or the little drogas to take provisions out to the deeper water where the big ships would be. Now, the big ships couldn't always come in to the harbor.
Right.
They could, but not everywhere they can do this because you have what they call the breakers, which is a coral reef.
Right, the coral reefs. But even when I was growing up, and I'll talk about that more when we're doing Westmoreland, you know, the sugar ships that came into Savlamar to refuel or pick up sugar or whatever had to be piloted into the ports.
But we're
talking about sail ship in those days. But I just want to read something here because it's so important as we talk about, you know, technology getting smarter and better. You know, one thing comes in and it kills something else. You know, the advancement of something in one industry can cause another part of that industry to not be important anymore. You know, so here it is now. We talked about the sailboats having to wait for a month sometimes before they could take off and set sail.
Yeah.
Now, the advent of the steamship was a heavy blow to Falmouth, because the first steamship came to Jamaica in 1837, and after that, steam gradually replaced sail. But the Falmouth Harbor could not handle big ships without expensive improvement.
Okay.
More and more of the coastal trade was delivered to towns with good natural harbors or to Kingston itself. Falmouth was further bypassed with the extension of the railway in 1894 from Kingston to Montego Bay. By 1890, Falmouth had become almost a ghost town. After decades of population decline, the population had been increasing, one cause being proximity to tourist resort areas. Because, you know, I suppose at that time it was not close to that. Now, the very isolation of Falmouth has helped to preserve its historic heritage. That's why this man says it's so important to restore some of these buildings. In 1990, a team of conservationists described the significance of Falmouth in this way. No town of the Georgian era besides Falmouth has retained its original beauty, and most of which were slave squatters. Part of the buildings, of course, were slave quarters attached to the planters' houses. And they say the reconstruction, of course, would be just massive. And there's archaeological evidence that, you know, that can date back, way back to the importance of saving this for some reason. But here in Falmouth, many are intact. Other parts of the island, what I mean is they've deteriorated more, and there's no evidence in some parts of the island of buildings and things that were erected in the 17-something. But somehow, because I suppose this was laid out differently, a lot of what remains in Falmouth is still intact. And a remarkable display of what may be called the cabin style of Georgian architecture is still there and should be retained. This is an excerpt from this same person who restored the great house at what's the White Witcher at Rose Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really buying for some restoration to be done.
All well and good, but in modern times, the building boom in that era is actually fantastic. And there's no way that people are going to go back to those Georgian styles because they have very modern and very nice homes in that area now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm talking about the big, huge development of nice homes.
Right. I suppose that is the really people who are into history, you know.
Yeah. But I'm saying, you know, the hope for restoration is very dim.
Right. Especially with the new generation of investors and people making money, they're not as interested in the past, at least now, when they're, you know, in their 30s and 40s, as they may become as they get older, because were you that interested in this history we were going over when you were younger, Mr. Nunes?
No, I wasn't.
I don't think so.
Keen on it. I mean, even after I purchased property in the area we're talking, I was more interested. They have a very fine beach there,
right?
In the area, and that's mainly what I was interested in.
Right,
not the structure of the houses, or even the sugar estates. In fact, I wasn't aware of the sugar estates until I went around the clock. There's a big clock in the center of the town, and behind the clock, I went into an area called Gordontown, and I had to pass these sugar estates. I did not know that sugar growing was done behind there, and it only goes to show you that, you know, what you don't see, you don't see. You see those hills, the rolling hills that we were talking about before?
Mm-hmm.
That's visible, and you don't imagine that people are up there. But on the plains, the foothills there, is all this sugar activity going on that you have to go around the corner to find. And that was really interesting to me, you know. And you do smell the rum, Donna.
You actually smell it.
Is
it the cane burning that you're smelling, or the actual rum?
What you really smell is the molasses. That's the first process of making the sugar, you know. But you also smell the aging process, which is more rummy, in other words. I worked in a sugar factory in Brooklyn, and you get that sort of smell there. After you store sugar for a while, you get that fermented smell, which is rum.
Mm.
You know, so.
Well, the oldest building in Falmouth is the St. Peter's, is the parish church, Falmouth Parish Church. It's an Anglican church. It's of St. Peter's, located on Duke Street in Falmouth, and it was built in 1795. And the picture I'm looking at here, it seems in very good condition. It is both the oldest public building in the town and the oldest church in the parish of Trelawney. The land for the church was donated by Edward Barrett. That's the same man who sold the property for the whole town. part of whose estate has been bought to lay out, had been bought to lay out the town. In 1842, the church was enlarged with a western extension, which now forms, you know, part of some special part of the church. But it's it looks good. The church looks quite modern from what I see here. It's a late picture because I see sort of late model cars parked in front of
well,
it.
Well, that church would be protected, you know. In other
because
words.
It's Anglican or why?
No, because it's the what do you call them? The people that preserve
the historical
building.
Society.
Yes, right. That particular church would be. It was like the first Anglican church there, you know. And in fact, in 1825, the office of registrars was established there in
mm-hmm.
Falmouth, and
right.
They were able to tell from that parish church when. You know, when people started to buy the gravestones and people the marriage certificates, you could go there, the office of registrars, and the research. You know, people like you were talking about the Lindos and the William Nibbs and people like those.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
All those big names.
Right. As I mentioned before about Trelawney being the place where most of the Maroons were found, I wanted to just, I don't know if a lot of my listeners know this, but I didn't. On June 26, in 1796, The British set 543 Maroons on three ships, the Dover, the Mary, and the Anne, and sailed them off to Halifax. I wonder if they had to wait for a month sitting on the ship for a wind to blow them there, because that sounds very far.
Well, a bunch of them probably would jump off and abscond up in those hills.
Right. But anyway, they, you know, after they could not control them, they decide to ship them away from, I suppose, the port of Falmouth. It doesn't say here, but that's where the port was. So they piled 543 of them and sent them to Halifax in Canada. Now, these immigrants were known as the Maroons. It mentioned here. The Maroons were black rebels that since the early 1600s tortured and harassed new British colonists. The fighting between the two races went on for years until the Jamaica government finally beat the Maroons at the late date of 1796. The government decided that the best way to deal with the rebels were to export them to Canada. After much debate, it was decided that the Maroons would be exported to Halifax, Nova Scotia. After arriving in Nova Scotia, the Duke of Kent, the commander-in-chief of the North American Division of the British Army, was immensely impressed with the spirit and pride of the Maroons. He immediately employed all of them to work on the Halifax Citadel. The Maroons were also impressed Lieutenant somebody, Sir John Wentworth, who believed that they would make good settlers. It was not long before he received orders from the Duke of Portland allowing them to settle in Nova Scotia. During their stay in Halifax, the Maroons received financial support from Jamaica, allowing them to purchase 5,000 acres of land on which they could settle. Did you know about all of this, Lane?
No.
This was news to me. You should see my eyes when I'm reading this. You can imagine now, these are a bunch of rebels. They're the slaves who got away from the Spanish.
It would be interesting to see if they had sowed any seeds go up the
Oh, yes, they did.
Now.
I'm going to come to that. I mean,
okay.
I was so intrigued by all this information.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading it verbatim, or I'm trying to. You know, for my listeners, this is the senior senior. And you should see my glasses. I mean, I have to contort my head in different positions to try and read this, so please bear with me. And it's because of this why I'm so fascinated, because I'm old. I'm so fascinated with history, I suppose, right, Donna? Because when I find this different information, you should see I'm just like a little girl.
Okay, let's hear what happened to these maroons now.
So Britain, well, I'm asking people to just bear with me here because I'm trying to move the paper around so I can read it right. Britain also provided them with annually 250 pounds. Can you imagine that?
Hey,
I'm talking about 17 something. Mm-hmm. They were paying them. Hell. So, where am I? I lost my space. They were not only helpful in building the citadel, but they were also skilled fighters. They were organized into small military units after they arrived. This is in Canada now. They were given 40 coats with brass buttons and vest for the orders of their use. He believed that they would be very useful if there ever was an attack. During this time, there were fears of a possible French invasion. Ain't that something? However,
remember I alluded to that before.
But this was really juicy because all of these people came from Jamaica.
Yeah,
so, however, the Maroons were not happy in Nova Scotia. The climate was much colder than they were used to, and they were not interested in becoming farmers.
They were homesick.
Also being cooped up during the winter. They were all free, you know, and getting money, getting paid. The Maroons began to develop short tempers, and they began to get rowdy. After a few years, the work on the citadel was complete, and the Jamaican funds were beginning to run out. The Maroons began to become a drag on the social purse, so Sir John Wentworth finally had to admit that the Maroons were not as ideal as thought. The Maroons were dissatisfied with Nova Scotia, and it was obvious that it was not working out. Between Wentworth and the Maroons, it was decided that they should settle in Sierra Leone.
Uh-oh.
An African-British colony.
Uh-oh.
The only problem was Sierra Leone Company was already at odds with prior Nova Scotia settlers who were presently rebelling, and they wanted settlers of Christian faith. Now, remember, that place was a British colony, too, Sierra Leone. However, through permission and negotiations, the Sierra Leone Company finally accepted the Maroons. The majority of the Maroons were shipped to Sierra Leone in 1799, and they arrived in Freetown Harbor on October 1800. The 1st of October, 1800, it was there that they were commissioned to put a stop to a black loyalist revolt on the colony. Although many of the Maroons left Nova Scotia, a few remained. A census of 1917 showed that a few people in Preston, which is a part of Nova Scotia, are of Maroon descent. Isn't that something?
That's what I was wondering about.
So apparently there might be still descendants of them up to today.
Of course.
But that was a very interesting piece of information.
Now, you don't see that too much in history books, because the way it turned out, you know?
No. Isn't that something?
So I understand that they shipped them off to Nova Scotia with a bunch of money to pay the Nova Scotians.
They treat them very good.
Yeah, they gave them 5,000 acres of land.
Yeah.
But wasn't that based on the... Did Jamaica have to give them some money or something?
Yes, Jamaica sent money every month. They sent money for them every month, too. And we're talking about 1796.
But don't forget Jamaica is then British, you know?
Right.
And so then they start running out of money to send it, so then they're ready to get rid of them.
Only after the Maroons themselves
were dissatisfied.
Yes, they were dissatisfied.
Because they figure, but the important thing that I saw, that they were dissatisfied, the government, there were no drag on the government, so they decided to negotiate a deal. They never locked them up back. They did not enslave them again.
They couldn't. At this point, they couldn't, because they don't forget, they issued them uniforms, and they performed civic duties. The big problem was the weather. I mean, Jamaica man liked it warm.
Right. I just thought, when I stumbled on this, I said, holy moly. This is something else.
That's a good story.
Yeah, very good story. And that, as I look up on the board, I see we just have a couple more minutes to go. So I'd like to invite, first of all, I got so wrapped up, I forgot to tell our listeners just calling in that you're listening to Back in Average on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock. We're currently doing Discover Jamaica One Parish at a Time. We are on our 12th parish. Next week we are going to do St. Elizabeth, a very famous parish for Kingstonians. We know even people in Kingston, St. Elizabeth is a big town, a parish that we know, that I know personally, seem to know a lot about. I don't know if is it because it's close to Westmoreland, or close from where our people are from, Leigh? Can you shed a light on that?
I don't know. The Kingstons, and there was a lot of influence between those parishes and Kingston for whatever reason. I'm not sure.
Right. One thing I know that my father was involved with a church, and I know that a lot of his missionary work took him to St. Elizabeth, because I remember going there once as a child. But however, I also know that also people from St. Elizabeth would come to Kingston and be boarders, you know, to go to high school or something of the sort. So we'll talk about St. Elizabeth next week. But I want to thank our listeners online for sharing all of these nuggets of information that we've discovered, that to receive it. Nobody's putting up their hands to join the Labrish, and I want to ask you to just help us out here and just let us know if you're enjoying the show, if you have any suggestions of how we can make it better. After all, it's a lot for us that are regulars, because I get so much thrill from finding out these things. But it's also for you, and we would love to have your input. So we're asking you to join us, and do go to our website if you're online and check us out at www.backyardlabrish.com. So, Donna, do you have some parting words for our listeners?
Just pretty much just reiterating what you said, that is, you know, for everybody, go to backyardlabrish.com and leave any comments, questions, suggestions, and look forward to everyone joining us next Wednesday, same time, same place. And but you know, before I end, I just wanted to say to everyone that I had the pleasure of meeting Leigh in person here at Margaret's birthday. I think that I don't think it was rum that I had. I had quite a bit of wine, so I didn't get a chance to kick it up with Leigh, I don't think, but but I'm certainly glad that I had the opportunity and the pleasure to meet you in person.
Okay, Donna, same here, and maybe we'll have another party soon.
Hey, I'm not having any more birthday parties. That was the 40th.
Don't worry about it.
Doesn't
have to be a birthday party.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. All right. So good night from the Bronx.
Okay. Home of the Yankees. Yep. And if any, we have a couple more minutes, and I'd like to just tell our listeners that the whole purpose of Backyard Labrish is reminisce about growing up in Jamaica in the 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, to leave a footprint for our grandchildren and those after the next generation or the generations to come, that they can have, you know, some little glimpse of what our life was like when we were growing up. Or even now, I'm a lot interested in what it was like, you know, in the 1799 or when my mother was born. My mother was born in 1912, and I'm sure, you know, her mother was born 18-something. So we're going back as far as we can, because one of the reasons I am so thrilled with all of this is, Donna, I don't know if you realize this, but you are the one who really brought it home to me, even though I had the concept, you know, of having this conversation recorded forever, because things on the internet don't go away, and our platform that we use, Blog Talk Radio, it can be accessed through your computer. So long after I'm not here, these shows will be archived, and you'll be able to listen to your voice or my voice or information. So we hope that you will utilize it. You will tell your friends to check us out. On the website is the different shows we've done. We're almost going to be celebrating our anniversary in August, right, Donna?
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
we really want to ask you to participate with us. You know, let us know what you think. Send us a comment from our website or at the Blog Talk website if you get one of our links. Tell some of your friends to join us by calling in or, you know, going to our website. You know, just help us spread the word. We are not, the whole objective of Backyard Labrish was not necessarily to be a political platform or to, you know, say what's wrong or what's right, but just what is and what was. And there are so many lessons that we can learn from the past, people's behavior. We have a lot of people from Jamaica that originated there in different periods who have contributed a lot to the entire world, not just to our island or to themselves, because a lot of them left and did things all over the world. So we're just digging up information that we can share to make us proud and to bring back good memories of being born there or visiting there or just liking the culture or the place. So we hope that you'll help us spread the word and increase our visitors and just join us each week for the Labrish, because we pretend we're sitting in the easy chair and feeling the trade winds. And Donna, tonight I found out, as you might have been on at that time, where the sailboats that came into to Falmouth back in the days had to sit for a month and wait for the right breeze to move their sail ships with the hog heads full of rum to get it to another port. So when I was growing up, all we did was enjoy the trade winds as we sat on the veranda or in the backyard under a tree. Because as hot as it is or was in Jamaica when I was growing up, you could always depend that later in the evening as the sun went down, those trade winds would pick up and you would have just gorgeous weather. So, Donna, I hope one day you'll get to taste that kind of weather.
Yeah.
You're there?
Yeah,
where you can look forward to the breeze every single evening.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool. No, and I meant cool as in the now language. And it was cool, too. I must let our listeners know that I'm a senior, but I keep up with the young folks. And Donna is one of the young folks. You know, I like to have young friends because I can understand the talk of the period. So I'll say that I hope you had a nice evening with us here in the backyard. And I hope you'll come back again next week when we do St. Elizabeth. And whether you're from St. Elizabeth or not, or if you know someone from St. Elizabeth, bring them along so they can perhaps tell us a special little story about their special Bammy or a special memory of growing up in St. Elizabeth or visiting St. Elizabeth or something that they might lend to the Labrish. So we're going to be signing off now and hope that you make it a wonderful week next week. And remember, as I mentioned before, we're going to have Christmas in July because we're closer to Christmas now than we were last month. Donna, did you know that?
I'm sorry?
I said, you know, we always have Christmas in July here in the South. So that means that we're closer to the end of the year than we were last month.
Yeah.
So it just reminds us of how quickly time flies.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you do have a goal or an interest, you know, go after it and get with the program because time is speeding up. It seems like it's speeding up. It certainly isn't slowing down. So with that, I bid you good night, and I thank you for listening and hope that you join us again next week. Bye from the backyard.